Welcome to the TED Interview. I'm Chris Anderson. This is the podcast series where I sit down with a TED speaker and we get to dive much deeper into their ideas than was possible during their TED talk. Today, my guest is one of the most recognizable names in the world, Monica Lewinsky. Most of us know a version of the story. In the 1990s, Monica was an intern at the White House. She had a relationship with Bill Clinton. The details of it were made public, and Monica faced years of public humiliation. I first met Monica back in 2015, when she was just starting to reemerge into public life. And the woman I met was very different from the woman I'd assumed from the stories I'd read. For one thing, just her determination to turn her trauma into something good for the world was really striking.
There is a very personal price to public humiliation, and the growth of the internet has jacked up that price. Millions of people, often anonymously, can stab you with their words, and that's a lot of pain. And there are no perimeters around how many people can publicly observe you and put you in a public stockade.
I sat down with Monica and talked to her about the years following 1998 and why she decided to come back into public life and how her story relates to the Me Too movement. Monica, it's great to have you here on the TED Interview. Welcome.
Thanks, Chris. Nice to see you. Be here.
I guess lots of people want to know more about your story. My thinking about the conversation, tell me if this works, is that the last thing we need is to go through all the facts of what happened. Those have been endlessly rehearsed.
Hard agree.
But I am really interested in the psychological history of what happened. Now, I was trying to imagine what it was like, and let's try this sort of experiment. And this is really for people listening. Like, go back for a minute and think of the time, assuming you're older than 21, 22 now. Think about your early 20s and think about the most embarrassing thing you ever did then, or the most embarrassing thing that happened to you, whether sexual or otherwise. Imagine that. And imagine you wake up tomorrow and the details of that are in every newspaper, on every website. They're all over cable television in detail. And that then repeats the next day and the next day, pretty much for a year. I mean, Monica, that's kind of what you went through, and it's kind of astonishing that you're here and smiling
right.
And healthy. And
grateful. I'm very lucky. I think I'd add to your thought experiment. Not only does that happen, but it's also all under the threat of a legal investigation.
Well,
you know, so I think the thing people
right.
often forget too was that yes, there was the public shame and the humiliation, but also for 8 months I was worried about going to jail. You know, and the threat of prosecution for my parents, and so that this didn't just happen to an individual, it happened
yeah.
to a family.
I hear that. And let me just ask you to talk about the trauma that you experienced. How would you describe that now? I mean, it feels like what you went through is an extreme version of what probably quite a few people today have gone through in different ways. Talk about especially the trauma of being all over every newspaper, all over the internet, and having all these things that you did being exposed to
right.
everyone.
I think, you know, so many of us, we're all really familiar with public people, right? So, and usually when we get to know about somebody in the public eye, it's because for one reason or another, they've chosen to be there. Right.
Mm.
So an actor has worked really hard to become successful. A politician has worked hard to become elected. And this was a really different scenario. And there are not many instances where somebody was a completely private person and without choosing to, they become a public person. So without engaging in something that they knew would become public, which I didn't. So maybe some people might say that was naive. And I will completely agree that at 22, I was naive in some ways. I think the experience for me to just kind of see two different Monica Lewinsky's emerge into the world, you know, that there was me, the person that I knew and whom my friends and family knew and loved. And then there was this public Monica Lewinsky. And that public Monica was created in many ways by some facts and a lot of fiction too. So I watched as that person almost snowballed, and it was devastating. So, I mean, it was a terrifying experience, not only to witness and see in the moment, but also as the many years unfolded, to kind of see the long shadow of the ramifications of what that meant, to have my narrative ripped from me, to be redefined that way, and at such a young age.
So talk about the media side of this and how the experience was to you. Like internet was early still. The story was broken on the Drudge Report initially. Did you find yourself drawn into sort of reading some of these stories online and reading the comments, individual comments from members of the public?
Unfortunately, yes. I remember there actually being a period of time when I had gone to stay at my dad's in LA instead of being in DC at my mom's. And we didn't have the internet. Like at my mom's place in DC, we didn't have the internet in the apartment. So I had to go down to this post office type place to use the internet. But my dad had internet. And what that meant was I was waking up early every morning. I was going to read everything on the computer, in part, I think, this sort of like masochistic, I guess, trait. But also there was also an element of, I think, because of the legal aspect of what was happening, I was also very cognizant that I may be finding out information. So that was also
part of you feel, I have to know, I have to know.
And just kind of trying to understand what was happening. But there came a point in time where my dad and stepmom sort of put down their foot and said, you cannot do this before, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, this just can't, because I would not only start my own day wrapped in even more anxiety and fear and sometimes hysteria, but it just infected and permeated the whole house.
I mean, this is a phenomenon that has never happened before in human history, where literally thousands of strangers can write words that are incredibly hurtful to someone who they don't really know. And every time those words are written, there is a sort of a stab of something. I mean, I've seen people, and I've occasionally been in the middle of some of these storms. Mm-hmm. And when you feel, for example, if I feel that Ted is being unfairly criticized by people who really don't know what they're talking about, you take it so personally, and you feel this is just like it hurts in a way that there was no parallel prior to the internet doing this.
Right. Well, I think that we don't give enough credence to the feeling of being misunderstood. And I think kind of all the layers that come with that. And I think that there's that level of injustice almost that comes with a feeling of misunderstanding. And is at the core of, I think, a lot of disagreements that happen, or kind of this friction which happens online.
I mean, it's one of the other pieces of it that you can't, when it's online and you know that someone is misunderstanding you or they have it wrong, you can't do anything about it. You actually can't reach out to them and say, no, if you knew me, you would know that actually isn't the fair way to characterize this.
Right. No, it's true. I think what's, as a public person, I don't know if people who aren't public people go through this, but as a public person, what I also find challenging is that you have to think, when you want to try to correct someone or respond to them, that it could become a story. Mm. So it doesn't even just get to stay within the confines of a communication between two people or a public communication on social media. It then could be even, you know, further taken out of context. And so I like to joke a lot about my drafts folder on Twitter, but you know, it's, I think that you do have to stop and sort of, you know, for many different reasons, but sometimes I stop myself from commenting and trying to correct things.
So after a year of this, I mean, basically the legal threat went away. Eventually, the scandal moved off the front pages. President Clinton ended his presidency as one of the most popular presidents ever. Life went on. But you, not so much. Like, you had to carry this unique experience. Tell us how you managed those following years, how you fought to regain your mental health.
Right. Well, I think for me, the trajectory was the first few years kind of post-investigation and impeachment were really about trying to learn to navigate my new normal. You know, I had been this private person, and overnight I became a public person and then was embroiled in this investigation for a year. And almost everything that I had to do was now different. And there are people who, I know that there are people who've gone through experiences in life that are different, who've had to do that. If somebody has a, you know, an accident that leaves them without a limb, they have to learn to navigate a new world in a different way. This was challenging because it was also in some ways in the public eye. I was also struggling with PTSD. I think those first few years I tried to sort of be more of a public person and did a number of things that were on the public stage. And after several years, that just didn't really feel right. So I retreated and moved to London and got my graduate degree in social psychology from London School of Economics. And I think that part of that for me was about trying to, you know, sort of build this new scaffolding upon which I could kind of hang a new identity. And I very naively thought, oh, you know, I will leave public Monica Lewinsky in New York City, and now I will be Monica Lewinsky, the graduate student in London. And it was actually at graduate school. You know, it's just so interesting the way trauma works, because it's almost as if it all gets dumped into you, but then you don't see some of the threads of it till years later. So while I had certainly been impacted by being called dumb and stupid and a bimbo in 1998, it wasn't until I was in graduate school that I really saw the full spectrum of how that had affected me, how I couldn't get up in front of my class to do a presentation, how I was so afraid to, gosh, it's weird, it's like making me emotional now, but I was so afraid to go ask for help in how to like do this certain essay because I was afraid it would expose that I didn't know something I was supposed to know. Afraid that I would sort of maybe reveal to myself I really was that stupid bimbo. So I think that was interesting. And that was something I then came to work on after I left graduate school. And it was kind of after graduate school, I guess, that I kind of entered what became this dark decade. And it was really a very long period where I had first spent several years trying to find a job, which I couldn't get, and then trying to find purpose. You know, so, and that was almost in ways worse than 1998. 1998 was sort of this, was like somebody pushing the button with the electric shocks, and this kind of dark period was just a constant pain, deep pain.
I can picture that because of you, your identity, you know, that added complication to any sort of job offer, and it pushed job offers towards offers that you didn't want.
Right.
But so these 10 years of darkness, can you say what that actually felt like?
I think what was interesting for me around that part, I mean, it was unbelievably challenging. And I think part of what was so hard was that I watched as so many of my friends were moving forward in their lives, you know, getting married, getting degrees, having children, second children, divorces, new marriages, that they just, their lives were moving forward. And I was so stuck. And so not only stuck emotionally, stuck in my life, but also publicly frozen in amber. What it would, you know, that period was just, I mean, there were days where it was like I would get up and I would drive to sort of somewhere far away because it would take up time, and I might run errands and just try to keep myself busy. And I had no purpose. And then I'd drive home and I might the next day go and return whatever it was I had bought. I mean, it was just, it was a really empty existence. And I, you know, and I didn't take care of myself in the right way. And I was in unhealthy relationships at times. And I think I did a lot of things to myself. I don't know if I can articulate this, but it was like there were a lot of actions I took or circumstances I got myself in because I was trying to externalize this internal pain and shame that I felt. And somehow it was like almost a self-flagellation in a way.
You would deliberately put yourself into it, not consciously,
but I think as I moved out of that, I think I was able to look back on that period. And I think there was something for me in, I've somehow gotten myself in a situation which is very painful. So maybe I had gained a lot of weight, or I, you know, was in something toxic. And it was almost as if the chaos and the pain of that allowed me to sort of feel something that I thought, oh, I should be in pain. But it also was a kind of mask for the real pain of what I had actually gone through that was too hard to look at. And, you know, I was lucky to have, you know, my parents were, and my step parents at the time were sort of all very supportive in different ways. And my mom in particular, you know, my brother and I kind of tease her for being sort of Pollyanna-ish, but there actually was something, there was a value to me of her saying, it'll change, don't worry, you know, keep trying. I think both of my parents in different ways, you know, just keep trying. But I think what I came to see sort of in the last several years was I had very much been trying to run away from who I was. And the reality was that I needed to integrate. I needed to integrate my history into who I was becoming as a more mature adult. And that was hard. And it is hard because that took a lot of, I had to transcend a lot of shame. You know, it's interesting. There's like a very defined distinction for me between when people say move on, you know, move on from something. But really, it's about moving forward. And those two things are really different for me. And the forward is about not, I don't think we can necessarily, in moving on, just leave things behind as if they didn't happen, you know, because right. They become unhealed scars in a way.
I think that makes sense. I'm curious even about the whole story around shame. I mean, shame, it just strikes me, it's such a complex thing. Like, in principle, what shame should be is that if someone does something shameful, they should feel shame. That's how it should go. But that's not how society, that's not how it works at all. People do, there was nothing you did that in the moment that it was done was in a way that morally different from what thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people do. Right.
Although many people consider that immoral.
Some people might consider it immoral, but is shame something that you have to own in that circumstance? Or is the healing process to say, I don't deserve to feel shame over this? What is the healing process?
I think it's somewhere in between, you know, so in a way, I think for me, what happened was I had to peel these layers of shame off. And part of that came from understanding, accepting, trying to forgive myself. I still work on that. And that's also wrapped into my trauma. So for me, it's, you know, a Gordian knot at times, but,
So talk to me about that piece of it. Cause a lot of people, when it comes to sort of getting, I don't know, closure or healing from something that's traumatic, people talk about, you know, the need for forgiveness and, like how core is that? And how much is it you forgiving yourself versus forgiving other people versus them forgiving you versus like how do those pieces fit together in your mind?
I think, you know, for me, from my experiences, I think that nothing else could move forward until I started that very slow journey of being able to forgive myself. And I think that all of those other things are wrapped around it, because the anger and the disappointment and the betrayal, it lives as a bitterness within you. And so it actually, when you forgive someone else, it benefits you more than anybody else. And also there's mistakes and regret can have very long tails, you know? And so I think there are ways that I come up against things that are challenging for me to deal with in my life presently that are connected to bad decisions I made 20 years ago.
And regret is complicated, because I think about the things in my own life that I regret, and I find that I sometimes regret them, but then sometimes I actually don't, because that I've only had one life. They're part of my narrative. How do you know that if that thing hadn't happened, that something else would have happened? I mean, how do you frame your regret? What do you regret? Do you regret ever, like, what would you whisper to your 21-year-old self now? Yeah. If you could whisper.
Leave DC.
Really, right from the whole, the whole thing.
Yeah, just the whole thing. So I think I could have very easily had a, fulfilling life, having not been an intern at the White House. So I had to accept this is what's happened. I'm unbelievably grateful to be in a place right now where being talking about my experiences and what I've been through and what I've survived, that that helps other people is extraordinary for me. So, I mean, it's just, it's probably one of the greatest gifts. I know it sounds a little corny, but it's probably one of the greatest gifts I'll ever have been given in my life.
Well, it's not corny at all. I think it's amazing in its own way. And in fact, I'd like to hear more about it. So you, because this goes to how we got to know each other when, yes. You know, a few years ago, you know, we saw that you were starting to be a bit more visible. Mm-hmm. You'd written a piece in Vanity Fair, you'd given a talk, mm-hmm. and we wondered whether you would give a TED talk.
Well, here's an example of like a long echo of trauma is that I thought it was a joke at first. So, I mean, I didn't, when the person I work on communication strategy with emailed and said, oh my God, look at this. I thought, are you sure it's not a joke? Is this real? But okay, back to, it was on Halloween. October 31st, 2014 was when I saw the email and the invite.
Well, we were, you know, you were already in an interesting space. I mean, online shaming was clearly becoming a big, big problem. And in many ways, it sort of foreshadows some of the more recent social media issues of today. And wow, yes, there couldn't be anyone in the world more qualified to do it. So we were highly interested and were excited when you said, well, maybe let's take this
right.
forward.
I spent a month actually trying to think about what, you know, what was my idea worth sharing. And I think if I didn't have that, I didn't deserve to be on that stage.
You're looking at a woman who was publicly silent for a decade. Obviously, that's changed, but only recently. It was several months ago that I gave my very first major public talk at the Forbes 30 Under 30 Summit. 1,500 brilliant people, all under the age of 30. That meant that in 1998, the oldest among the group were only 14, and the youngest, just 4. I joked with them that some might only have heard of me from rap songs. Yes, I'm in rap songs. Almost 40 rap songs.
It was clear at the time we invited you that if anyone would ever invite you to the TED stage, you would probably come with more nerves, more reason to be nervous than anyone ever. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably right. So talk about, I mean, there's lots of people scared about public speaking. So just talk for a minute about how you, who are probably more scared than anyone ever, how you overcame that and ended up giving a spectacular talk.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think if we rewind a little before I did the Forbes talk, which was before my TED talk and kind of the first big talk I had done, I recognized when I accepted that invite that I didn't really know how to do this. And the one thing I didn't want to do was get up on stage and make an ass of myself. So I was very lucky and had two different people, one of whom was Graydon Carter, recommend someone in London who helped people find their authentic voices.
At the age of 41, I was hit on by a 27-year-old guy. You know what his unsuccessful pickup line was? He could make me feel 22 again. At the age of 22, I fell in love with my boss. And at the age of 24, I learned the devastating consequences. Can I see a show of hands of anyone here who didn't make a mistake or do something they regretted at 22. Yep, that's what I thought.
I wanted this to come from me. I wanted my communications to be authentic. I didn't want to be scripted in any way. So the two things that came out of that were so helpful to me, one was a sense of confidence that they felt what I had to say was of value to society. So that was something I needed. But the second, and this was really came about before the TED talk actually, was being given the advice about finding something outside of myself for the reason for the talk. And for me, it was this matters. you know, so this matters not for me. This matters for other people who need to hear this. Yeah. And that was probably for someone who is so self-critical and, you know, somewhat narcissistic at times that was kind of, I think that was the most important thing, because that allowed me to step in to do something that was important to do. But as I was thinking of coming to see you and talking to you about this too, I was remembering something that was really interesting to me. And this is kind of it's not off topic, but that I had felt, you know, that I had acknowledged my regret many times publicly. Mm. And I had done it then again in the Vanity Fair essay. I had done it in the Forbes talk. And I thought, okay, well, maybe now it's time to move forward from that.
So like me at 22, a few of you may have also taken wrong turns and fallen in love with the wrong person, maybe even your boss. Unlike me, though, your boss probably wasn't the President of the United States of America. Of course, life is full of surprises.
And there was a really interesting back and forth, I think, with some people here and people elsewhere around this idea of no needing to sort of still acknowledge that, which I still felt. So it wasn't as if I no longer felt regret for my actions. Of course I did. I still do.
Not a day goes by that I'm not reminded of my mistake. And I regret that mistake deeply. In 1998, after having been swept up into an improbable romance, I was then swept up into the eye of a political, legal, and media maelstrom like we had never seen before. This scandal was brought to you by the digital revolution. That meant we could access all the information we wanted, when we wanted it, anytime, anywhere. And when the story broke in January 1998, it broke online. It was the first time the traditional news was usurped by the internet for a major news story. A click that reverberated around the world. What that meant for me personally was that overnight, I went from being a completely private figure to a publicly humiliated one worldwide. I was patient zero of losing a personal reputation on a global scale almost instantaneously. This rush to judgment enabled by technology led to mobs of virtual stone throwers. Granted, it was before social media, but people could still comment online, email stories, and of course, email cruel jokes. News sources plastered photos of me all over to sell newspapers, banner ads online, and to keep people tuned to the TV.
I don't know if it's kind of pulls back to sort of those deep archetypes that we have of sort of things around the differences between the sexes in that way of, you know, certainly Bill Clinton hasn't chosen to apologize as many times publicly as in a way I felt I had been expected to. And eventually I didn't have a problem with it because, you know, if that's what I needed to say for people to be able to hear the message, then I was fine with that because it was authentic and true to me. Mm-hmm. But there was this point where I just kept thinking, you know, when do you get to stop saying I'm sorry?
I can imagine you wrestling with that. I personally mm-hmm. thought what you said in the talk was, at least for that audience at that moment, was exactly right. And so this talk ended up being the smash hit of the conference. It exploded to many millions of views online. Basically, you turned your experience into a call for the world to think about cyberbullying and mm-hmm. And how to defuse it. Talk a bit about that, about your thinking and where it's gone.
Mm. Well, I think what prompted it was what came out for me when I experienced my mom experiencing the tragic suicide of Tyler Clementi.
I was on the phone with my mom in September of 2010, and we were talking about the news of a young college freshman from Rutgers University named Tyler Clementi. Sweet, sensitive, creative Tyler was secretly webcammed by his roommate while being intimate with another man. When the online world learned of this incident, The ridicule and cyberbullying ignited. A few days later, Tyler jumped from the George Washington Bridge to his death. He was 18. My mom was beside herself about what happened to Tyler and his family, and she was gutted with pain in a way that I just couldn't quite understand. And then eventually I realized she was reliving 1998, reliving a time when she sat by my bed every night. Reliving a time when she made me shower with a bathroom door open, and reliving a time when both of my parents feared that I would be humiliated to death, literally. Today, too many parents haven't had the chance to step in and rescue their loved ones. Too many have learned of their child's suffering and humiliation after it was too late.
So, it's been extraordinary on a very personal level for me, and I think for my family too. One of the most shifting things has been for me when parents tell me that they've watched the talk with their 13-year-old or with their 16-year-old. That's been incredibly meaningful to me because I think nobody would have put their money on, you know, Monica Lewinsky, the cautionary tale, becoming Monica Lewinsky, someone who has something to share of value. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, for me personally, but also in a way of feeling that there's, you know, this a purpose to my past and sort of changing that pain. And I've seen that reflected too in teachers who have tweeted me that they show the talk in class and in grade schools. I think also too, I had this, you know, I mean, on a funny level, it's been a great thing because people have stopped saying to me, you know, no offense, but do you know who you look like? And now it's like, oh, I loved your TED talk. So, which is like, that's a great shift. You know, that way. And I had a funny thing one time. It was a few months after the talk, I got together with a friend of mine from graduate school, and she told me a very moving story about her cousin who had been going through a hard time, and she had gone to see him in LA. And she noticed on his desk that he had handwritten out on this piece of paper a long quote from towards the end of my TED talk. And that it had been this part about sort of forgiving yourself and that we all deserve compassion and you can insist on a different ending to your story. And I think that was one of the first instances I had of feeling as if there was this ripple effect to the talk and that it was, you know, doing something good and a vehicle for healing for some people or a part of a healing journey. So.
And I would guess that some of the biggest impacts of the talk, we may actually never know, not because the story wasn't told, but because the impact was that someone who was going to write something cruel to someone else just had pause for thought, you know, and who knows, you can never replay history and calculate the
thank
impact
God.
Of that. I guess, thank God. I mean, I don't know. It's one of the biggest intellectual puzzles I have, let alone anything else, of what would change and what would actually be the same. As you said yourself, your life could have been dramatically different. Mm-hmm. And then who knows, you know, maybe as a result, there would be some teenager today who would never have got the wisdom from you and something terrible would have happened to them. You just can't.
Right.
It's so wild that we never get to replay the tape.
Right. And I think too that it's not always easy to do, but I think that the quicker we can kind of like knit in the new experiences we have, whether they're positive or negative, but particularly it's harder with the negative ones and kind of integrate them and move forward with them, the better it is because we can't change them. You know, no matter how much we want to go back, we can repair them, but we can't change them.
So you're continuing to talk on this issue and to be influential on this issue, but also in the last couple of years, you've been asked to comment on Me Too and that and all the issues around that. Talk to me about how you think about that, because I, you know, it's felt like that's been complicated. You have been very vocal at times saying it's wrong to frame you as just, you know, a victim. You know, you're an agent, and yet this is a story about abuse of power as well as everything else. So talk about that.
Well, I think it's the Me Too movement, which, you know, started 10 years ago, that Tarana Burke started. It's an example of one of the positive ways social media has helped us. I don't think hashtag Me Too would have exploded in that same way without social media. Or, you know, I think in the course of the conversation, just recognizing that there can be positive things from the internet. What happened for me, I think, with this movement and my experience of it was, it was like I was almost planted in a different soil, a seed sort of put into this different, more fertile soil for a specific way to kind of come to look at and understand my own experiences. I had written about this, but as somebody had reached out to me who had been very public in this movement and had said that she was sorry I had been so alone. And it was really kind of in the tears that just, you know, poured out of me after I read that, that I started to recognize that there maybe was something for me to look at here, that it wasn't a binary movement of you were assaulted or not assaulted or harassed or not harassed, that it was more nuanced. And I felt then and I still feel now that there are many more voices of Me Too stories that should kind of be heard and get attention before mine, because I don't think that I'm a perfect fit into sort of all, I don't tick all of those boxes, but I do think that it's a very important story around abuse of power.
Talk about how we should think about that.
Well, I think it's that we never should have even gotten to a place where there was a yes or a no, did I want to or did I not want to? That question of consent was already kind of tainted by the fact of the extreme inappropriateness, in part because of his station, his job, his privilege as a powerful white male. I mean, I was also privileged, but I think for a very long time, I just saw the abuse as having been something that happened once it became public.
Right.
And as a result of the Me Too movement, and I think my maturity and my healing, but the ability to sort of see how I had been gaslit, to see how there had been abuse and abuse of power from the very get-go, that we never should have been on the precipice. We never should have been standing in a room alone. But I think particularly as a public person with my history, I've just seen so many people try to decide whether or not I was a victim.
Right.
And that age old question of victim or vixen, and which is a question we shouldn't be asking in 2019.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. The answers to that question is not always at one end of the spectrum. And that if our worldview only allows it to be at one end of the spectrum, we are missing something important. In other words, that yes, there are obvious cases where someone has been a complete victim. They've been assaulted,
right,
and they had no power over it. That's one thing. But there can also be really unfair instances where it's not as clear cut as that, but nonetheless, something unfair happened because of unbalanced power situation.
Mm-hmm. You know, obviously the end result is worse in the other scenario, but it's almost kind of similar to the short skirt issue. You know, if a young woman was, or an older woman, if a woman was wearing a short skirt, was she asking for it? You know, so that there's sort of that somehow is different than somebody who might have been covered up head to toe somehow, that even though that end result was that they were assaulted. But I think the bigger question or the bigger thing that I hope comes out of this, aside from systemic change in not only the workplace, but kind of the ways that we're looking at equality really in society, is also around the conversations of victims and targets and trauma. I've heard since the beginning, I think many people have, you know, the conversation, or there was one last week of should so-and-so, who, you know, fill in the blank of usually a man who has been hashtag Me Too, should they be allowed to get their job back? Should they be allowed to X, Y, and Z? But I actually think the focus and the questions should be different. The questions starting out should be less about what does the perpetrator need to do right now? What do they need to do to redeem themselves? And it really, you know, before we're worrying about how to, for the perpetrator to come back, we should be focused on helping to repair the people who've been harmed.
Well, Monica, you've felt this, it feels like, and more than a lot of other people. And what I'd love you to do is, if you could write a little love letter to a 21-year-old who's curious and alive and trying to figure out what she wants to do in the world, other than the obvious things like beware internships in the White House. Right. What are some things you'd want to implant in that young woman's mind or that young man's mind and anyone in that formative stage of their life?
I think probably the most important would really sort of be an echo of what I said in the talk, which is really that you can survive anything and you can move past it. You know, forgive yourself and know, I hate to quote myself, but you know you can insist on a different ending to your story, that it's not over till it's over. It's one of the reasons that I'm so grateful for having had the opportunity to give a TED talk and for teachers playing this in school. And I used to, most of my friends have kids, a lot of them do. And I'm kind of various names of Auntie Monica, you know, some call me Bob, but, you know, it's, and I used to worry so much about what was going to happen when they would get to that place in their history class in school. And all of a sudden, you know, if their parents hadn't talked to them before, like, what? That's Aunt Monica? You know, that's sort of a narrative. And so this, I marvel at it all the time, and I'm grateful, and my family's grateful. And this idea that instead or alongside that narrative that had been there for such a long time is a different narrative. That's, I hope, is the lasting impact. And that's what I would try to impart, is you can't imagine it now. You can't imagine it being different or better, but it can happen.
Well, the fact that 21 years after that nightmare, you're sitting here. you've rebuilt your life in a beautiful way. So, I mean, it's hard to imagine anyone going through anything where what you just said isn't applicable, that you actually can get past this. If you, Monica Lewinsky, have been able to do what you've done in the last 20 years, anyone can. And so thank you for the inspiration of that. And really wish you so much luck in your next chapter going on from here.
Thank you.
Bravo to you. Thank you for this.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, that's a wrap for this episode. If you'd like to learn more about online bullying and what you can do to help fight it, please check out the Tyler Clementi Foundation at tylerclementi.org. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find the whole season of the TED interview at TED.com or on BBC Sounds. This show was produced by Sharon Mashihi. Our editorial director is Michelle Quint, production manager Roxanne High-Lash. Our mix engineer is David Herman, and our theme music is by Alison Leighton Brown. Special thanks this week to Anthony Gordon Lennox and AGL Communications. I'm Chris Anderson. Thanks so much for listening.